Hello and welcome to this week's Behind the Headlines podcast. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell, back from vacation. In today's show, we'll talk about what a new kind of cooler means for one local company. And columnist James Causey breaks down some of the best haunted houses in the area. But first, did you ever dissect a cat or a frog in high school? And do you think you could dissect a human brain? One of our reporters did. Here's Mary Louise Schumacher talking to reporter Mark Johnson about a class informally known as the Brain Camp.
So, Mark, you have a story running this Sunday about a pretty enthusiastic neuroscientist who, I love your description of him jumping in the Prius and making his way, you know, hundreds of miles to these brains in buckets at Marquette. And he is coming along with students from around the country for what's called Brain Camp, right? So what is Brain Camp?
Well, actually, that's sort of an informal, that's what his wife refers to it. It's basically, it's a very unique course in continuing education. I don't think there's another one like it in the whole country. And it's a three-day dissection of the human brain. And they get 102 people from around the country and as far away as like Singapore and Dubai. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a chance to see the brain in three dimensions. And you look at it in a lot more detail than you would in, say, medical college, medical school class.
And who comes to this class? Who are the people that show up to study the brain in this way?
Well, it's not brain surgeons. Fortunately for us, or for those of us who get surgery, they already know the brain pretty darn well. So the people who come are psychologists, neuropsychologists, therapists. There was one person that was a nursing home administrator. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of people that have good reason to want to learn more about how the brain works. I mean, a lot of what they do revolves around trying to understand how other people's brains are working.
And Mark, you've done a lot of stories that have dealt with neuroscience. Did you actually get to go and attend some of this class? And have you ever seen a brain before? What was it like?
I went through the whole class. Part of the experience was I wanted to, you know, kind of take the class, and I actually did some of the dissection. Mm. Although I found that It's difficult to cut into a brain. At least there's a barrier for me because part of it is that you realize it's such a precious resource. It's very hard for them to get, you know, lots of brains. Mm-hmm. And you feel this incredible burden not to make a mistake. I mean, there's no do-overs with a brain. You don't want to cut out something that is a key feature.
Mm-hmm. You talk about in your story the reactions that some of the people in the class had to the brain itself. You know, this thing that, you know, we're kind of identified with, this organ in our body. It's that a lot of people think who we are is in the brain. And some people had some very kind of philosophical reactions to that. Tell me about that.
Yeah, there was one woman, one of the main people in the story. She's a therapist who works with sex offenders mostly. Mm-hmm. And I mean, a very difficult group to work with. But she wanted to understand parts of the brain that become important in their conditions. It was interesting because I think that she was the most nervous of any of the people I talked to. I talked to four or five people before the course just to see what they were feeling, how they were feeling going into it. And some of them had already dissected things, like had taken gross anatomy, which is the sort of classic medical college class. But she had never actually even seen a brain before, and she was very nervous. She was thinking beforehand about, you know, well, if I get really freaked out, you know, maybe I'll have to step outside. But what was really interesting was she had a lot of very sort of profound thoughts, I thought, when we talked about it after the experience. She had said, for instance, that when she was looking at the brain, you know, one of her thoughts was, you know, does this object in front of me still retain anything from the living human person who had it? You know, is there some remnant that's left after our deaths? Mm-hmm. Another one of the things that she noticed was at one point they get to examine brains that have had diseases or been damaged mm-hmm. from things. And it holding the brain that has, for instance, you know, suffered from Alzheimer's disease, mm-hmm. the disease becomes less of an abstraction. It's something that you can actually see. Mm-hmm. The ridges on the top of the brain, the what are called the gyri and sulci, you can actually see they're shriveled in, mm-hmm. you know, somebody who's had Alzheimer's disease. It's a very visual, you know, effect.
That story ran in Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but there are several additional features available online. Check out our video about the fascinating parts of the brain, available at jsonline.com/news. James Causey is best known as one of our columnists, but he's also a haunted house enthusiast. It started when his dad took him to see Jaws as a kid. He's been a horror buff ever since. In fact, James has been to about 300 haunted houses over the years. And what does it take to make a haunted house stand out?
Well, a good haunted house needs to have a number of factors that play on your different senses. Like, you got to have darkness. A good storyline helps, like, what makes this place a haunted house, or why was it created in the first place? You need to have great actors. Great actors make or break a haunt. And also the attention to detail. You know, it needs to be some periods of darkness, but it also needs to have, like, great detail. Like, if there's a scene in a hospital, you know, the blood needs to look real and the corpse needs to be real and all that kind of stuff, because it adds to all the elements that you see.
Which one was your favorite haunted house that you went to this year?
I had a number of favorites, but, you know, they all are different in their own way, and that's what I like the most about them. Like, for instance, Abandoned Haunted House was off the chain this year. It gets better and better every year, and I went 2 years ago, and I didn't think it could get any better, and it did. Waukesha, the Fear Grounds out there, I like that because they offer so many different elements at one location. And they added another element this year where you can participate, where you have 10 friends and you try to participate in this game where you try to unlock these keys in a short period of time. You got like 50 minutes to figure out this puzzle, and you have to figure it out before this monster gets out and is released and he gets you. It's like a Kraken or something like that. So that was a little different. This other haunted house is all... Terror on Rural Street was probably the most improved haunted house. It's an all-volunteer haunt, meaning that everyone who helped put the haunted house together were all volunteers. And that place really took me, it blew me away, because I used to go to them, you know, like I went to the first Terror on Rural Street like 10 years ago, and I seen how far they've come. And now they really have it all together now, and it was wonderful. So it was good to see them improve.
And you weren't able to make it to every single haunted house.
Right.
So how did you pick the ones that you wanted to review?
Well, I try to hit the local ones, of course, and try to give them a pub. And what I look for history, too. Like, for instance, Mars Haunted House, they've been in business for over 2 decades. You know, it's a great haunt in the city. It's right on Mitchell Street. They have, great history. Klein, the owner of the haunt, is used to work in a funeral home. So, you know, it's always good to get there. And it's one of the smallest haunts on the tour. It's like 5,000 square feet. But when you're in it and there's so many twists and turns, it feels like it's much bigger. Waukesha Fairgrounds, it's like a no-brainer. It's usually one of the best haunts out there. And it's recognized nationally as one of the best haunts in the nation. And then one that I picked, too, in Racine, I can't think of the name of it right now because you get them all mixed up, but Racine, I think it's Fear Factory or something like that. It's black-owned. It's the only black-owned haunted house in the Midwest, and one of very few in the nation. So that's interesting, too.
What's your favorite memory of visiting a haunted house?
Actually, you know what I get a big kick out of, because I walk through them now and nothing really scares me. I like going through a haunt with novices, people who really don't, like their first or second time going through a haunted house. And you get to see their reactions, and you know, for instance, I went through a haunt with three teenage girls at, they were probably 14, 15, 16 years old at Mars Haunted House, and they screamed at everything. You know, you hear a boom, boom, and that was like fantastic. And walking behind them made the haunt even better.
James's reviews ran in Friday's newspaper, but you can explore them online at tapmilwaukee.com. It's a motorized cooler on wheels with MP3 capabilities, speakers, and headlights. Best of all, it comes in your team's favorite colors, logo included. How have products like this helped the company through the recession? Here's Joe with more.
Well, one thing that they've done is they've really, really expanded their product mix since the recession. So they make everything from plastic wheels or tires for center pivot irrigation sprinklers, giant irrigation sprinklers that you see in farm fields in the Midwest, to plastic eyewash stations, to plastic garbage cans in school colors. But then they also make metal parts for over-the-road trailers. They make a variety of parts, and I think he told me they said about 1,500 products under roof. So if one portion of the economy hits a rough patch, they can shift over to another portion. So one thing he said they were heavily into was the new home construction market as the recession hit, and we all know what happened there. He said, yeah, that didn't work out well. So they've learned to really diversify their manufacturing base to weather the economic cycles that hit various that just hit various segments of the economy.
This isn't the first story you've done on tailgating. Before, you kind of took a look at the industry as a whole and how some of the luxury products, such as generators that can power TVs, have come onto the market. What's interesting to me about that is it's happening at a time during, you know, an economic recovery from a recession when people are still kind of hesitant to spend. You would think that, at least I would think that, tailgating would be one of the things you could cut back on. You wouldn't necessarily buy the cooler that moves or the TV or whatnot. So how are marketers getting people to purchase these products?
You know, I thought the same thing. And, you know, I think people have gone without for so long, that some people, that they're to the point now where, you know, they might not buy a new house, but they might spend money for a generator or, you know, a cool cooler with headlights and an MP3 capability. And then, you know, there's other people who are doing pretty well. I mean, there are some parts of the economy, there are some professions that are doing well. Others are somewhat stagnant, and that is just characteristic of a really uneven recovery that we've experienced and that we've seen since 2008.
And for a broad subject like tailgating, how do you come up with specific stories to tell?
You know, the stories, I think, kind of tell themselves. It's just, you know, you try and use your imagination to come up with stories, and then you see something like a motorized cooler with headlights and a Packers logo, and you think, wow, that's really something. Somebody, you know, came up with that, designed it and engineered it and builds it right here in Wisconsin.
That story also ran in today's edition of the Journal Sentinel. It's available online at jsonline.com/business as well. Congressman Paul Ryan is seeking to replace John Boehner as Speaker of the House. How has he fared on our PolitiFact Truthometer ratings? editor Greg Borowski and PolitiFact writer Tom Kircher weighed Ryan's record during this week's JS on Politics show.
Paul Ryan about to ascend to the speakership of the House. By all indications, we thought we would take a quick look at his record on PolitiFact's Truthometer. We're joined now by Tom Kircher, one of our PolitiFact writers. And Tom, we're going to roll through some of these recent claims. Mm-hmm. The first one is from blogger Eric Erickson, who was not a fan of Ryan as House Speaker. And he says, Paul Ryan is one of less than 36 Republican congressmen to have voted for every bailout to come before Congress. And we rated that mostly false.
Bye. Right. There were three major bailouts that we looked at. Paul Ryan voted for two of them, but voted against another one. He voted for the bailout of the banks, known as TARP, and he voted for the auto industry bailout. But he voted against bailing out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the enterprises that are set up to help with home loans.
Okay. All right, and let's look at some now from Paul Ryan himself that we've done over the past months. And this is Paul Ryan, who says, Medicare is, quote, going broke. The trust fund goes bankrupt in 2026. That's one of his big issues. We rated it mostly false.
A couple problems with this one. There was an estimate that part of Medicare, not all of Medicare, Part A, which primarily pays hospitals, that trust fund would run out of money by 2026. But that doesn't mean it would stop operating or be bankrupt. There would still be funds flowing in. And if Congress didn't make any changes, Part A of Medicare might have to be scaled back, but it wouldn't be bankrupt.
All right, and this is another issue that Paul Ryan has taken up. He says, over the past 3 years, deep poverty has reached its highest level on record, and we rated that true.
Deep poverty is a measure of very poor people, so Americans with an income of less than half of the federal poverty level. And we found he was accurate in the three most recent years that have been measured. That percentage of very low-income Americans has been the highest on record.
Okay. All right, we have another one from Paul Ryan. He says, 20% of single adults ages 21 to 25 with no kids are not working or even in school trying to find a job, and we rated that one false.
And in this case, Paul Ryan actually admitted he was misquoting a statistic. There was a federal number relating to younger Americans not working or not in college, but there's not a federal statistic for the group he cited, which was younger Americans without kids and single.
All right, and lastly, Paul Ryan said recently, Miller Brewing is not a U.S. company anymore, neither is Anheuser-Busch. It could even be one company soon, but our rating was true. So,
yeah, there was a discussion about taxation and whether companies in America moving headquarters overseas to get lower taxes. And in that context, Paul Ryan mentioned that the parent companies of Miller and Budweiser are no longer here. Parent company of Miller is in England, parent company of Budweiser in Belgium.
As always, a replay of Thursday's show is available at jsonline.com/politics. The show is also available as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Green Bay Packers defensive lineman LaTroy Guyon was known for having some off-the-field issues. But the Journal Sentinel's John Dietrich and Michael Cohen found more troubling reports about Guyon's past. The Journal Sentinel's Matt Montgomery talked to Cohen about that story.
I'm joined this week by Packers beat writer Michael Cohen to talk about his big story with John Dietrich and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about Packers defensive lineman LaTroy Guyon. Michael, what can you tell us about this story?
It was a really interesting story to work on. John and I spent a lot of time on it over the last, it stretched over a month now that we've been reporting on this. And basically, we had gotten a tip from somebody who, just sent me an email one day and said that there might be something worth looking into in regards to the background of LaTroy Guyon, who had been previously arrested in February, and then he served a three-game suspension at the beginning of this season, for violating the league's substance abuse policy that stemmed from that arrest. So we started looking into his background and going through and gathering all kinds of court records and police reports and anything we could get our hands on. And it turns out that there was, a decent amount of criminal activity in Guyon's background. And some of the most interesting parts of it were that he had been charged with battery, three counts of battery. This stemmed from two different altercations, one in which he got in a fight with a man and a woman, and then another incident where he, according to police reports, punched his cousin in the side of the head. And so you started to see, just sort of an interesting background to this guy who had, you know, basically the police report said he punched his cousin, and then he also punched two additional people, one being the mother of his child, allegedly struck her in the jaw. And then in the same altercation, he punched her then, her boyfriend at the time, in the back of the head. So, you know, there was all of this stuff going on in the background that sort of was never really publicized, and certainly wasn't publicized at the time that it all took place, which was back between 2011 to 2013, I believe. And during that time, Guyon played for the Minnesota Vikings. So what became sort of a key point in the story was whether the Packers looked into his background and did a thorough enough review of his character, or whether they missed some of this stuff, maybe they overlooked it, or perhaps that's not true. Perhaps they knew about all of it, and they just decided that it was okay to re-sign him and bring him back even after his arrest in February. So it was just sort of a little bit of a look at a guy's background that hadn't really been brought up before, and there were some really interesting things there, especially given the domestic situation, since that's one of the most hot-button issues in the NFL right now, aside from concussion.
Have the Packers or Guyon responded to your guys' reporting?
Not yet. All throughout the reporting process, we were told that Guyon was going to decline to comment through a spokesperson for the Packers. Coach Mike McCarthy and general manager Ted Thompson did the exact same thing. They also declined to comment through a spokesperson for the team. So we have not heard anything yet from the Packers, from Guyon, and the NFL declined to comment as well, which is consistent with their policy. They don't usually discuss suspensions. So we haven't heard anything yet, and when the week gets started with practice on Monday, I believe, it'll be interesting to hear what they have to say.
What was the biggest surprise to you throughout the reporting process?
I think the biggest surprise to me was that, you know, just about everything that we found, actually I think it was everything that we found, was available through public records. We were either able to get it through the actual websites of various courts throughout the United States, or we were able to put in calls to police departments or sheriff's departments to get different police reports or records or photos, whatever it may have been. And so that sort of surprised me a little bit, because when all this Guyon stuff happened, and by that I'm referring to the domestic incidents, you know, he was playing for the Minnesota Vikings, so he was a prominent NFL player, and all this stuff was there. It was available to anyone who wanted to see it, but it was never really talked about and never really discussed. And it had been brought up in very small forums since then, you know, but nothing really to the point of, you know, major publication by, you know, a newspaper in the town, in any of the cities where Guyon had played. So it was really interesting to me that this sort of faded into the background, even as guys like Ray Rice, a former running back for the Baltimore Ravens, and Greg Hardy, a former defensive end for the Carolina Panthers, made headlines across the country in 2014 for some of their domestic issues, while, you know, Guyon's just sort of faded away a little bit and weren't really mentioned.
Once again, I'm talking with Packers beat writer Michael Cohen. You can find his work at jsonline.com/Packers, in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and on Twitter at Michael_Cohen13. Michael, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
To read more, pick up Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can also find that story online at jsonline.com/Packers. And with that, we'll wrap up today's show. Thanks so much for listening. If you're a fan of this podcast, be sure to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. And join us next week for more.